We're happy to announce that Randy and Nancy Nichols were baptized last Tuesday night here at the downtown building. Our baptistry is out of commission at the present time, but Randy and Nancy, would you all please stand? Where are you? And stand up and let us meet you. Where are your boys? They're up here. Oh, here's one and another one, another over here. All right. We're so happy to have you folks. Thank you. Be sure to meet this young couple after we're dismissed, and their three fine children. They'll be a blessing to us, I know. We're so glad to have those of you who are visiting with us on this day. It's always special. The Lord's Day is always special. As you're aware, though, this is the first day of the new year, and that's important. But more important than our being aware that this is the first day of the new year is our being aware that this is the first day of the rest of our life. That's really important. Whether it be 6 months, 6 weeks, or 60 years, this is the first day of the rest of our lives. Now, that's important for those of you or us who have been dissatisfied with our past life. Never mind. You can't change a second of it. It's already gone. And this is the first day of the rest of your life. And it's up to you and me as to what we make of the rest of our life. Or it may be that you're satisfied and pleased with your past life. Well, be careful. If you're wise, then the best is yet to come. If you're unwise, you'll sit and rest on your laurels, and then you're really in trouble. When I was about 40 years old, I came one day to this sudden, sobering realization that the buck stops with me. And I meant by that, it suddenly dawned upon me that I could no longer look to other people to fight my battles. I had no right to look to other brethren older than me to answer questions in the brotherhood or to write books or to fight battles or to do the proclaiming or to do the defending. It suddenly occurred to me, all right, you're at the age now, you either do it or it won't be done. And I meant just not me, but all others who were in my age group. By the time you get to be about 40 or so, it should be done by you and me, and we have no right to expect other people to do it for us. But it also occurred to me that what I do, I'm going to have to do now. Now's all we've got. Right now, today, this very moment is all we've got. Yesterday is already gone. Tomorrow may never come. If you've got any time at all, it's right now, N-O-W, now. And I don't mean to imply or to make you think that there's no eternity. Quite to the contrary. And it's because there is an eternity that right now makes so much difference. Because, you see, we're preparing for eternity. That's why we're here. That's our purpose. That's our occupation. We're preparing for an eternal city that God has prepared for those who love Him. And consequently, we must be about our business. Someone said we'll have all eternity to celebrate the victories, but we only have a few short hours before sunset to win them. And I would like to ask you to consider some things this morning as we begin this new year and as we begin this first day of the rest of our lives. I would like to ask us to consider, how can we go about winning these victories? We will have an eternity to celebrate them, but how can we go about winning them? And if I can answer that question for you today, it will be one of the best New Year's greetings that I can give you as a Christian. There's a strange and colorful statement made in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verses 14 and 15. Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine upon you, or will give you light. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time, because the days are evil. One translation simply says, redeeming the time. And another one says, buying up the opportunities. Buying up the opportunities. this figure here is, it's not unusual, it's not strange to us. We've waked people up before and said, wake up and get up off the bed. Get about what you're doing. I think simply that's what he's saying here. Awake, old sleeper, and get up off your couch. Get up off your tomb. A dead person lies in a grave or a tomb. A sleepy person lies on a bed, his couch. And so he's saying here, get up and be about your business. And Christ will show you how. He'll show you how to redeem the time. He'll show you how to buy up the opportunities. And he says you need to be wise. Don't be unwise. But redeem the times. Buy up the opportunities. I'll tell you one thing this does not mean. It does not mean when it says buy up the opportunities, be careful, bury your talent rather than risk it. It doesn't mean don't take any wooden nickels. It does not mean a host of other things that would imply such caution that we would not venture out. It doesn't mean don't ever stick your neck out on anything. That's not what it's talking about. What this passage says is get about the business of the Lord. Get about the business of living your life for God. Go on and risk. Do whatever is necessary. Invest. Engage yourself. Be about it. Let's be hot on the trail for following God and for doing His will. That's what buying up the opportunities would urge us to do. You can picture in your mind a person with a newspaper under his arm, hurrying downtown, perhaps even before the stores open, because he's a bargain hunter. I've got a son that every time that Searcy shopper comes, that's the first thing he does. He goes out and he reads the whole Searcy shopper because he's looking for bargains. And then in a minute, he'll be gone out the door. I say, where are you going? I'm going to Kensett. Why? Well, there's a bargain over there I want to buy. And he just goes like a scavenger. And some of you ladies in this past week, the post-Christmas sale, you find yourselves going downtown, rummaging through tables of materials and tables of odds and ends, looking for bargains. And when you find one, you lay your hand on it and you seize it. You seize that opportunity. And so it is, that's what he's talking about here. Robert Street used to take me down to various places, but he took me one day to the futures market. And there he showed me up on the board some indicators that would show what the status of the market was. And he was involved in buying or selling, if the need arose, futures as it related to wheat and grain and cattle. That was his business. He worked in that. I think we ought to follow his example in our Christian life. That's our business, buying up these opportunities. Jesus said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, because the night comes when nobody can work. He was so practical. He was saying, I've got to do what I'm going to do now while the opportunity is mine, because the time will come when I won't have any more opportunities. That's what he's telling us. Do the work of him that sent you while it's day, because the night's coming when nobody can do that. But the question arises, what is the work of him that sent me? Do you know, so many of us don't know. So many of us are really unaware of what God's work really is for our lives. What does he really intend? What's his plan for my life? A man came through my office and came through town the other day and stopped by my office. And in the midst of the conversation, he said, he told me about a preacher that he knew up in the north that really didn't know what God's work for him was. He thought that his wife and children were an obstacle to his doing the will of God. Can you imagine it? Yeah, I can imagine that. This man looked upon his wife and children as being a threat to his doing the will of God. And he quoted this brother, the passage when his brother told him, look, your primary responsibility is to your wife and children in doing the will of God. That's it. Your secondary responsibility is to other people. But he looked upon his wife and children as a threat to his doing the will of God. He said, no, that's not right. They are your number one opportunity to carry out the kingdom of God. And he says, well, how can that be? It says, seek his kingdom first. He just didn't understand what the work of God really is. Here are some opportunities that are the work of God. You've only got your children a few years. Buy up those opportunities. They're rare. You fathers, if you've got a few moments with your son by himself, if you can take him to lunch one day, take him to lunch. Buy up that opportunity. Those of you who travel, can you take one of your children with you? Buy up that opportunity. They won't always come. Do you have an opportunity to help a son or a daughter to sit down with him and really and truly communicate, buy it up, while they're young, while they're still playing with toys? Because the day will come when the toys will be left behind and they'll be gone. And what was a noisy, rambunctious house will be very quiet and just as dead as a tomb, and those opportunities will be gone. My father brought up an opportunity with me when I was about 6 years old. I never will forget it. I was mowing a huge field, really. It was huge to me, but the grass was over my head. I was 6 years old, and the grass didn't have to be all that tall, but I was out there with a lively lad, and he passed by and just saw the lively lad come up every once in a while. He didn't even see my head. Well, he stopped the car, and in his clothes, in his suit, he got back there in that field with me and helped me mow that grass. I bought up an opportunity with my oldest son over in New Zealand. There came a hurricane one day, and he was out delivering papers. And I remembered what my dad had done for me, and I'd always hoped that I'd find some opportunity that I could buy up to do that to my sons. And sure enough, he was out there delivering papers in the middle of a hurricane. Well, I went and bought up that opportunity. I went looking for him in the car, and I found him. He was just literally leaning at about a 30-degree angle trying to make some progress against that wind. And when I drove up and blew the horn, he turned around and he said, "Oh, Daddy." Man, he was so glad to see me. And so we put the bicycle in the car and we delivered those papers in the car. That was buying up an opportunity. I wouldn't miss it. I just didn't want to miss it. Well, there are other opportunities. Husbands, you have some opportunities with your wives to treat them like you would treat your own flesh. Take her to dinner. Do something kind for her. You won't have her always. The day will come when she'll no longer be by your side. Death will claim her. You better use the time while you've got it. Wives, love your husbands. Treat them like you would want to be treated, because the time may very well come when he'll no longer be by your side. Use those opportunities while you have them. All of these are opportunities. There are many more for those of us who live in Searcy. Let me urge you, please, buy up the opportunities that are peculiar to you here in Searcy. There are giants here in this land, and I mean the giants of God. There are people here who are aging. They won't be with us forever. I've never been in a place where so many people converge in such a small locality. People who have enormous talents, people who have tremendous influence, people who have already influenced the church and the world for much good. We just pass them by and speak and go on our way, missing those opportunities. Where we could say to them, "We want you to come to our home this coming week. We want you to eat dinner with us." Buy up those opportunities. I've let too many already slip by me, and I'm speaking to myself as much as I am or more than I am to you. Buy up those opportunities. The Merritts, the Shoemakers, the Bensons, these people, great people, and many, many other people. Buy up the opportunities to be with them. Glean from them those facts and glean from them their experiences that will help make you and me a better people. Opportunities that are in Searcy for attending events that we sometimes just pass by. I suppose that this congregation may very well be the poorest of all congregations in the Brotherhood, perhaps, as far as it comes to taking advantage of lectureships. Well, we don't really go to lectureships. Workshops? Teachers' workshops on campus? Well, we don't go to those much. What's the matter? Well, they come every year, you know, they're... And we end up missing them. Concerts, orchestras, huge symphonies come here. Not everybody here attends. I don't attend them all either. But I'm going to start being selective, and I'm going to start making sure that I don't let anything pass me by that will be good for me as a Christian. The men's encampment this coming week, Friday night and Saturday morning, the men of this congregation are going to meet with the elders and with a man from Montgomery, Alabama, who is a world traveler, evangelist, missionary. There's an opportunity for you men, for us men, to be out there and glean from these elders and from this man. There's an opportunity for you. This is your time. And you men, if I could say this is one time when more than at any other time in our calendar of this congregation, when you can have an input into the direction of this congregation, this is it. This is your opportunity. You just mustn't miss it. And you could just name them over and over and over and over. Opportunities that come our way. And if we're not careful, we'll not take advantage of them. Ray Blanton told me just, or through his sister Betty, Ray Thornton, excuse me. There's a Ray Blanton I know from somewhere else. Ray Thornton is Betty Ulrich's brother. And he told her regarding the running for Senate, the U.S. senatorship, he said, that opportunity doesn't come often. And he says, you have to take advantage of it when it comes. And so he's running. I think he would have preferred not to run this time. But he says the opportunity just doesn't come all that often. Someone said opportunity is never forever. It's like a horse that comes galloping up and pauses for a moment. And if you don't get on, very shortly, you'll hear the galloping footsteps dying away in the distance. Then it's gone. And you stand there wondering, well, maybe it'll come back. It'll never come back. Another one may, but that one's gone forever. It's so necessary to take advantage of now. And especially is that true if you're in such a stage of your life where much of your life, or at least a significant part of it, has already gone by. If you're 40, if you're 35, 50, it's so important to go on. Do what you're going to do and do it now. Last year at the encampment, Brother Andy T. Richie spoke in a devotional, conducted it, and it was entitled Morning, Noon, and Evening. And I was so impressed by it, it scared my mule. It just scared me. It made me realize that I need to be about what I'm going to do. And he likened our life to a morning and a noon and an evening. And it made me realize I was sitting right in the middle of midday. And if I was going to do anything, I better do it now. John Ruskin wrote his father in 1848 and made this statement to him. If one were to calculate average life at 80, I am now at noon. He was 40. You are at 6 in the evening. His father was 60. With both of us, the day is far spent, and I never think of my day's work much after 12. Yet I fear, forgive me if I'm wrong, that neither of us has either chosen our master or begun our work. What a pitiful and sad realization to be at 40 years of age or at 60 years of age and not really ever to have chosen your master or really ever to have decided on your work, because the day is far spent. I must work the works of him that sent me while it's day. The night comes when nobody can work. In order to do that, you're going to have to realize something. I read a book recently entitled The Best Half of Life. And in it, the author, Ray, and his wife, Ann Ortland, made this startling observation. This terrified me also. It was frightening. There is no holding pattern, he said. Here is an out-and-out warning to anyone who thinks he's gone into a holding pattern. You know what a holding pattern is? It's when you just maintain the same altitude and circle. He said, there is no holding pattern. You're dipping. And this is what's so frightening, he says. It takes you about 10 years to find out that you've dipped. And you're not the same person you were. When you start coasting, you start to vegetate spiritually. There is no holding pattern. I don't know whether you are aware of that. I don't know whether you're aware of the possibility of it in your own life, the tendency to want to coast, the tendency to want to put yourself into a holding pattern. But Dr. Ortland suggests two or three things that I'd like to pass on to you. Number one, it takes a recommitment over and over for you to keep from going into a holding pattern. Now, when you get to be about 40, 45, you've got some things under your belt, you've got some experience, you feel like maybe you've got a few things on the ball, and it is tempting at times to think, well, I'll just kind of sit back and I'll rehash this and I'll kind of hold into a holding pattern and we'll go on like this. It takes a recommitment over and over and over. You know, there's a downward drag in you. If you haven't seen it by now, you need to recognize it. There's a downward drag in me. I wish there were none, but there is one. And I have to keep on every day of my life fighting this battle over and over and over to keep from going into this holding pattern, because the holding pattern isn't there. It's a drifting pattern. That's why the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 2 and verse 1, we must give the more earnest heed to the things that we've learned, lest happily we just drift away from them. Drift. Drift. There's no holding pattern. We need to reestablish daily our priorities. We need to put first things first daily. We need to recognize that there are some things that are more important than other things, and daily reorder our priorities and reaffirm that which is important in our lives, re-examine what's there in our lives to see whether or not that is really why I'm here. Your business is not the most important business. God's business is the most important thing in your life. There are many things that outweigh many other things. Your life, as well as in far as it's related to your family, that's the most important relationship you can establish upon earth. Take care of your wife. Take care of your husband. Take care of your children. Take care of these nearest neighbors. That's important. This is doing the will of God. These are priority matters. Don't let them slip by. Let me give you an example or an opportunity to exercise this wisdom. There's going to be something happen tonight that's going to give you a real live opportunity to examine your priorities and establish something that's a priority over something else. At 6:30 or something tonight, what time do the Cowboys play? What? 4:30. Oh, well, you may miss the last half if you come to church tonight. You already checked into it, I knew. I figured if anybody knew, he'd know. 4:30. What are you going to do at 5:45? The score is tied 20-20. What are you going to do? You're going to have a real beautiful opportunity to make a decision about what's top priority in your life. Are you going to come here tonight and let us encourage each other toward going ahead and getting right and doing things for God for the rest of our lives? Or are you going to watch to see who goes in the end zone? Well, now, in order to do this, in order to recommit yourself every day, in order to recommit yourself when these opportunities come up, you're going to have to do something else. You're going to have to strip down. We're going to have to shape up. We're going to have to do what Sue Gates, the New Zealander, had a good expression. She says, get a grip. Get a grip. Whenever things were kind of going to pieces, she'd say, oh, get a grip. That means pull up your socks. You're going to have to strip down, get rid of some things. You're going to have to buy some things that really aren't what you need anyway. Soft living, soft Christianity, someone says, is the laughing stock of hell, and that's right. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9:24, do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Well, I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air. But I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be a castaway. Prune your life down. How many of you feel like you're just running in 100 different directions at once, and you're just getting you're just breathless at the end of, you know, of every day, and you're running in so many different directions and so many different interests and all? Prune down. Prune down. Learn how to say no. One of the blessings of being middle-aged is you can learn how to say no. I guarantee that one of the rights of a man that's past 40 is that he can say, no, I can't come. I've got something else that's important, and I can't do this other two. A lot of us work under such guilt feelings, though, that we feel like we never can say no to anybody. But I'll guarantee you, I read recently, someone says less is more. Less is more. In art, you realize that it's not just saying a little bit about a whole lot of things. It's picking out one little thing and zeroing in on it and then developing that to the nth of its potential. I read a book recently that said this in writing, that less is more. Instead of saying just a smattering about a whole lot of things that keep the reader running through there at a breakneck speed, he says narrow down, exclude, zero in on the real important things, and then say a lot in detail and colorful analysis of those few things. I was in the home of Randy and Nancy the other night, and he showed some slides that were taken with close-up lens. Oh, he could have taken a wide-view lens and gotten some real broad pictures, and he did. There were two or three of those, but the ones I remember were those with the close-up lens where he took a butterfly, and it filled the whole frame. Beautiful. I've learned, incidentally, in preaching that less is more in preaching. I used to say just a smattering about you know, from Adam down through the book of Revelation. That was about every sermon. I finally realized that less is more. It's better to say more about less. And some of you would be agreeable, it's better to say less about less. But more is less, or less is more in life too. The person who goes about at a 45-degree angle, running to meet this appointment and that appointment and this over here and this commitment, and then forgetting this one and apologizing for not being there and making apologies for not having the time to do what he said he was going to do, that person isn't all that productive. Oh, he looks good, though. Man, he looks like a moving star. But he's going to burn out. Prune down. Well, a third thing. Remember this. It's always too soon to quit. It's always too soon to quit. First of all, it takes recommitment every day. Secondly, you're going to have to strip down, shape up, get a grip if you're going to do it. And then thirdly, it's always too soon to quit. There's a story of a person who was an immigrant coming to America, and the ship wrecked. And he was flailing around in the water there, and he found a board, and he hooked his arm over that board, and he yelled out to another one of the survivors, "Which way is America?" He was on his way again. Even though it looked like disaster, it was still too soon to quit. Isn't there something that you want to do this coming year? Isn't there something that you've been planning, really, that you need to go ahead and do? Well, then go ahead and do it. Do it now. It's too soon to quit. Someone says, "Oh, well, I've got the rest of 70 years. Well, if you had 70 years, what about the first 5 of those years? You didn't know much about what was going on before you were 5, did you? No. Well, let's take 5 off of 70. That leaves 65. How many years do you spend sleeping? Oh, 25. How many years do you spend eating? Oh, about 8. How many years do you spend working at your job? About another 25. That doesn't leave but 3 or 4 or 5 years out of the 70 for you to use to do what you really and truly believe is the utmost in life. So you better get busy. But you know, you don't even know whether you've got 70 years or not. Keats died when he was 26, I think. Shelley died when he was 30. Schubert died when he was 31. Alexander the Great lived when he was 33. And I think Mozart died when he was 35. That's awfully short. Where are you? You better get at it. What are you going to do? Do it now. Perhaps you're going to write a book. Do it. All it takes is a big pad of paper, a pencil, and a lot of glue. You apply the glue to the seat of your britches and go to it. That's what somebody told me. And you know it works. But you have to start now. And on the other hand, it's never too late to start. Michelangelo, I think it was, that said that he began building St. Peter's Cathedral when he was 76 years old. Verdi was nearly 70 when he composed his Te Deum. Grandma Moses started painting when she was 78. If you've ever wondered why she was called Grandma, that's it. She was that old, 78. My father, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, accepted the invitation by the church where he'd been preaching to go ahead and preach there full time, every Sunday. He's 81. My mother said of him the other day, he's like a caged bull when he's not preaching every Sunday. Well, it's never too late. Never too late to start. Okay, Miss B., get those driver's licenses. I don't know where you are, but get them. Now, you may be past 55 or 60. Doesn't matter. It's never too late to start. Go on. Get busy and get at it. There's such a temptation to just think that we're going to just hold on. You're not going to hold. You're going to either vegetate or you're going to grow. So let's be at it. Let me give you one more passage before we close. In 2 Corinthians, in chapter 6, in verse 2, verse 1 says, "Working together with him then, we entreat you not to accept the grace of God in vain. For he says, at the acceptable time I've listened to you and helped you on the day of salvation." But the next part is what's important. "Behold, now." Now is the acceptable time. "Behold, now is the day of salvation." You see, God was aware that we only have now. And it's that time that we must employ we must utilize if we're going to do the preparation necessary to be the kind of people that He wants us to be. Today is the day of salvation, right now. Today is that day of opportunity. It's now. You may be here today and you've been putting off becoming a Christian. Now's that time for you to do it, not tomorrow. Now. It may be that you came to faith 40 years ago. It may be that you came to an expression of that faith in repentance 20 years ago. It may be that you've never been immersed into Christ. You're still outside Him. You're like a horse running a race, never having entered the course, running around the outside. You may beat everybody else, every other horse you may beat and come in first, but you're still outside the racetrack. You're still outside Christ. You're lost. There was a conversation in hell by some demons. They were trying to figure out what was the best strategy to damn the whole human race. And they gave each one their projection or their suggestion. And one demon said, I would go back to the earth and I'll tell them, be good to your neighbor. Love your wife and children. Be kind and considerate. Well, and all the rest of them said, what's the matter with you? You crazy? He said, no, I'd tell them to do all these things, but I'd tell them, do it tomorrow. Tomorrow's soon enough. You better do it today. And right now is your opportunity while we stand and sing.